Okay, David, this is where we're supposed to choose a side, green or black.
John, my soul is as black as night. Your turn.
I am black for life.
So we're not fighting? I thought this is where HBO wanted us to like pick sides and fight and stuff.
Don't worry, I'm sure we'll find plenty to disagree about on the pod, but we seem to agree on one thing. We both really like this show.
The politics, the drama, the lore. It was made for the lorehounds.
And since we just finished recapping season one, we couldn't be more ready to defend our Black Queen in the Dance of the Dragons.
And with the season pass option in Supercast, listeners can get early ad-free access to each weekly scene-by-scene deep dive, plus our custom show guide with all the characters and connections. See you in the Lorehounds podcast feed each week for our Dragonfire hot, but probably positive, takes.
The Lorehounds House of the Dragon coverage is also safe for Team Green consumption. Side effects may include a deeper understanding of dragon lore, a hardened conflict with itself, and an inescapable urge to read the book Fire and Blood by George R.R. Martin. Dragon seeds may experience burning.
Hello, and welcome to episode 6 of Rings and Rituals, Udun, from the Payne and McKay series Rings of Power. I'm Marilyn, the librarian of Rivendell.
And I'm Sarah, Shield Maiden of Rohan, and we're delighted that you've joined us. Now today, we'll again be reviewing what we mean by ritual, and then applying those concepts to different examples of ritual that we find in this 6th episode of the TV series. We'll explore them using a set of questions to reveal how Payne and McKay depicted the cultures that they were adapting to their series.
Please be sure to get in touch with us. A discussion of two is an adventure, but we'd love to have more voices join us. In fact, we have a lot of voices joining us today. You can email us at ringsandrituals@thelorehounds.com, and or you can join us on our Rings and Rituals channel on the Lorehounds Discord. We'll include all that information in the show notes.
And we also want to say that we are a proud affiliate of the Lorehounds Barovian Broadcasting Network, where you will find all sorts of interesting podcasts on TV, films, books, video games, and other stories. Our thanks to all the listeners who support the Lorehounds and also Rings and Rituals through good ratings on Apple iTunes, which boost our visibility, joining the Lorehounds Patreon, and other forms of donation. If you'd like what we're doing here, consider giving them a boost as well. Okay, as our regular listeners know, we like to start with a review of our definition of ritual, particularly for anyone who might be joining us for the first time. So, Marilyn, what do we mean by ritual?
Well, primarily and first and foremost, ritual is a repeated action. It's usually intended to recognize and or to bring about change. It often has symbolic content, but not always. I mean, people who are dog owners know that there's a ritual for walking the dog. Not terribly symbolic, but very important. And you probably follow certain patterns each day, although maybe you're like someone else I know who likes to take a different route every time. But the ritual aspect is it happens on a regular basis. It may also be a form of meaning making, which does not have to be religious or spiritual. People use fireworks for the celebration of many particular rituals. Like you don't usually have, well, you might have fireworks at Christmas, but usually you have them in the States around 4th of July and in the UK around November. Oh, remember
November 5th.
November.
Remember the 5th of November, Marilyn.
I just did. And so these rituals may create or reinforce communal identity. Although, of course, they're also solitary or personal rituals. Often, ritual gives structure and meaning to the unimaginable and may include humor, which can help one to bear the unbearable. So ritual can perform some really significant actions when life gets tough.
Mm. So we'll keep those points in mind as we describe each ritual and weave in the following sorts of questions. What is the design of the ritual? What is the intent of the ritual? What is the outcome? And particularly, what does that ritual tell us about the culture and the individuals within that culture?
So keep those things in mind because we're going to take a quick break now. And when we come back, we'll bring you the meat or the tofu for our vegan or vegetarian listeners without the quail sauce. Welcome back. Before we get started, we have something to share which draws a less obvious connection between The Lord of the Rings and Rings of Power. We've already talked about the ritual culture affirmation of the Harfoots. Nobody goes off trail and nobody walks alone. This is your first episode, you can go back to, I believe it's episode 3, where that comes in pretty significantly. Recently, though, while I was reading or listening, I can't remember which, to Lord of the Rings, I do both, I noticed an unexpected echo. Once the company reaches Rivendell, we have all of the significant hobbits together in one place. At one point, Bilbo says to Frodo, "We hobbits must stick together." This seems to be pretty similar to Nobody Walks Alone. And then, a little while later, we hear Merry and Pippin say to Elrond, "We don't want to be left behind." Now, I'm not going to try to tell you that this was Pan and McKay's direct inspiration in their creation of this particular cultural statement, but it does seem pretty familiar, and I thought it was a pretty neat connection. So I wanted to share it with you all, and I want to know, Sara, what do you think?
Well, to be honest, it doesn't really surprise me. When I think of hobbits, I think of community. Mm-hmm. And because of that, to me, it seems natural, this idea of sticking together, being together, working together. Think mm-hmm. about the hobbits we see in the Shire, either in The Hobbit or in The Lord of the Rings. And we're talking about big families and that sense of community and being together and partying together and eating together and drinking together. There's a whole lot of togetherness there. And when, for example, at the beginning of The Lord of the Rings, we have the folks in the pub talking about Bilbo and Frodo.
Right.
Because they are slightly different to that, because they are a little bit more individual, if you like, they are referred to as queer. Mm-hmm. Or cracked, or cracking. So I think for most hobbits, it's the norm to be part of what everybody else does. Now, we can argue forever about whether that's a good or a bad thing. The fact sure. that, you know, everybody's supposed to do similar things and those that don't are othered. But there is such a sense of community among the hobbits that we don't necessarily see amongst any of the other peoples that we come across in our reading. Hmm. So this idea of we hobbits must stick together and that link to nobody goes off trail and nobody goes alone, to me, that actually kind of makes sense. Mm-hmm. I don't know. What mm-hmm. do you think?
Well, it was particularly the phrase, "we don't want to be left behind," which is almost word for word, you know, when we're hearing Marigold talk to Nori and, you know, she and Largo are talking alone and she keeps saying, "We're going to be left behind." All I can say is, Pan and McKay, I'm sure you're listening to us every week. Please write and tell us. Was this on your mind? Or listeners, you know, if you've read something or heard something or whatever, I would love to know, because I do know that the showrunners have a deep knowledge of the text and a deep love for the text. So maybe it was subconscious or unconscious, you know, when they did that, but it just really struck me between the eyes when I gathered that.
Yeah, perhaps a combination of that idea of hobbit community feeling, but also, of course, the fact that the Harfoots need to stick together, because those that don't stick tend to, well, frankly, die.
Or get picked off. Yeah,
exactly. Yep. So for the Harfoots, it's a very particular problem if they're not part of the group.
Yeah.
By the time we get to the Lord of the Rings, it's more like being socially ostracized. But once you're, you know, going all the way back to the time of the Harfoots, mm-hmm. it's a matter of life or death.
Yeah, yeah. I just think it's kind of a neat connection. And I like to think of it as, you know, Harfoot culture expressing itself in you know, their eventual descendants in a slightly different way.
Yeah, I like the idea.
Good, I'm glad.
So we're going to review the ritual elements that we saw in this 6th episode, but to aid our listeners' memories, we'll also include a synopsis of events. Though to save time, we might leave out one or two scenes or compile some out of order for the sake of continuity. Now, please note, we're doing full-on spoilers throughout these episodes. If that isn't what you want, go and binge the entire season and then come back and join us.
Yes, please.
Okay, so, Marilyn, do you want to start with the first synopsis?
I will do that. Thank you. A daughter makes a small hole in the ground and plants seeds in it, saying, "New life in defiance of death in Quenya." He then goes to his army and speaks of how much they have yearned for a home and how they are now at the point of being able to claim one at last. The orcs respond with growling and grunting to this classic ritual of an encouragement speech, whether for an army or a sports team or something else. The orcs chant Nampat, which means death, as they march. They find the tower seemingly deserted, though there are still torches lit. The orcs fan out to search for people. In an upper portion of the tower, a Hrondir waits, listening for the right moment to bring the tower down on the orcs, who are then trapped inside the courtyard. From a distance, the refugees from the tower cheer as they watch it collapse. Bronwyn leads them back to the village, saying that they don't have much time to prepare.
Okay. Well, I think it's fairly clear one of the main things we find in this section, right, Marilyn?
Yeah. Here's Adar planting seeds and speaking Quenya in a phrase that sounds pretty ritualistic to me. And I wonder, where did that come from? How far back?
Right.
Because why would elves need to be defying death?
That is strange, isn't it?
They don't die.
No.
They do not die. And I think this is one of the challenges of any kind of adaptation of this series is remembering this key difference between elves and humans.
Mm-hmm.
And for the sake of drama and audience expectation and so on, the elves are depicted as being far more vulnerable than I think they really are.
Yeah.
Now, maybe if you're an Adar and one of the first who was taken and twisted or whatever, I don't know, maybe you don't come back if you are killed. But even so, the way this is presented makes it seem like elves have been doing this for millennia.
It does. And the only thing I can think, you know, giving a little grace to Peter McKay, if you like, is that it's new life in defiance of death, but it's not about the elves. It's about the world around them. I mean, after all, he's planting seeds. These seeds will burgeon plant life. And plants around them, the nature around them, that does have a cycle in which there is death and new life. And perhaps we could point to that as being a way of understanding this as ritual. I do find it highly ironic, though, given what it is he wants to do to that area.
Yeah.
Right?
Seriously.
So that, in fact, he's going to take an area that is relatively lush and green and turn it into what is going to become Mordor. So it's more like new death in defiance of life. But it does feel like a ritual that goes back a very long way, particularly, spoilers, when we see Arondir doing something very, very similar.
Exactly.
Later on. But the only thing I can think that is not, well, this is a bit of an error on the part of Peter McKay, is that perhaps this isn't about elves, it's about everything else.
That's really interesting. I'll have to mull that over for a while. I can see where that might be the case. I mean, I see where you're drawing it from, and you know, it has a good foundation there. But yeah, it again, it just makes me wonder, what is Adar's backstory? And I really hope we get some of that in the second season.
Oh, so do I, because I have to be honest, Adar is one of those characters in the whole of this series that really intrigues me.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, many of the other characters I enjoy. I love Arondir, I love Bronwyn, and don't get me started on Deesa, who is, in fact, my queen.
Oh!
Exactly. But Adar fascinates me. I want to know everything about him and his origin story.
Yes, yes, definitely.
Mm. So there's more in that little synopsis, actually, than just the planting of the seeds. There's that encouragement speech that he gives when he goes to speak to his army. And let's face it, that's everywhere in literature.
Yeah.
And, of course, Tolkien does something similar when he has, you know, the Battle of Helm's Deep, and he has the Battle at the Black Gate, and he does have that sense of leadership there, although it's not quite the scene that Jackson makes, of course, and it's Aragorn before the Black Gate. Although I have to say, that's a really good scene. It's Henry V.
I was just going to say, Crispin, and once more, dear friends under the breach and all that kind of thing, for sure. I also think of Arise, Arise, Riders of Theoden.
Yeah.
You know, that's another, I called it an encouragement speech because there's other things that people call it that I thought, well, that's not really Tolkien to me. Mm-hmm. So, but anyway, it's a battle cry, basically. It's a summoning of the troops.
Yeah.
You know, fell deeds awake, fire and slaughter, forth Aer Lingus.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a cultural statement, it's probably something they've heard before. It kicks them into high gear, right?
Yeah. It makes references to things that make cultural sense to them as well.
Right. This is what they do. They're warriors. They come forth, and when their lord calls them, they respond. So all of these things, ritualistic in the sense that you can imagine him saying it before, you can imagine how it affects them. It's a reflection of this warrior culture, and has a lot of meaning for them, I think.
Mm.
Now, I don't know if Adar ever gave a speech before to his children, but the sentiments are certainly things they've heard and felt and expressed before.
Yes.
So pulling all that together and reminding them of that as if they needed reminding, as a means of saying, okay, yeah, some of us are going to die, but that will be in a very good cause. And that's usually the gist of any kind of pre-battle statement, isn't it?
Yes.
Rousing the troops.
Right. That this will be worth it, that there is a point to this.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
And I think that this is showing great leadership on the part of Adar.
Yes.
Because we know already that they view him as this sort of strange father figure. But this is now a bit more than that, because you can be fatherly without being a battle leader. And I think
I hope
he's doing.
So.
Yeah, exactly. But I think what you get here is him showing that side of him, that he is not just top dog amongst the orcs, if you like, but he's also their leader into battle.
Mm-hmm. And their father, though. Again, I think back to that horrible scene where he tells one of his children to expose their arm to the light.
And yes, that's a rather abusive father.
Burns. Yeah, abusive father there, for sure. But the orcs pick up his enthusiasm, and as they march off, they are chanting. So how many times do we see that ritual of, you know, you keep in step, it brings you together as a group, you're chanting death. Maybe that's their version of defiance of death. You know, they can't plant seeds, but so they just chant the word over and over so that, you know, I'm not afraid. I can see that it might be death, but I also plan to bring death.
And that's the point, isn't it?
I think so.
I mean, what you don't want is your troops marching along singing tra-la-la lally way down the valley, because that's not going to keep them riled up.
No.
You need your soldiers riled up. And really on the edge with their adrenaline going, because that's the only way really to get soldiers into battle is to get them feeling that sense of urgency and power and strength in there. And there is a togetherness here, of course. We were just talking about community amongst the orcs, but there's a togetherness here because they march in step and they're working together and they're chanting together, and it's an important sense of connection.
Do you think elves have chants as they march to battle?
That's a really good question. Apart from Ore and Tuluva, of course, which would work pretty good, wouldn't it? Do we see any examples of that in Tolkien? And I'm not sure that we do.
I really don't think we do. And my initial reaction to my own question was, oh my gosh, no. But then why not? And do they have
something? It's not like elves don't go to battle.
Instead. And Yeah, I'm going to turn this one over for our listeners right in if you have any ideas about that.
That would be great.
Yeah.
You can imagine them at the, you know, the Last Alliance and, you know, marching together and with, you know, elves and men. And would they have that kind of common chanting and riling up and all that kind of thing? It does feel slightly icky with the elves, but...
It just doesn't, it feels off. And yet now I'm realizing that, you know, these are more things that are being chanted as they are moving and getting to be a unit. I don't think elves need to do much practice to move as one, if you see what I mean, or to, you know, to become a unit. Now, maybe I'm seeing them through rose-colored glasses. I don't know. But once they're out the field itself, I don't think they're going to be chanting. I think
Let's face it, elves have plenty of time for practice.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Would you like to give us the next chunk of synopsis?
Sure. Okay. In the hold of one of the Numenorean ships, Isildur awakes before anyone else and shares an apple with his horse, Beric. Halbrand is also awake, but he doesn't stir. Isildur goes up on deck to watch the dawn and catch sight of Middle-earth. Galadriel comments that all soldiers were to be asleep, and Isildur apologizes, but she recognizes his eagerness to have a first glimpse of land. When she learns that he is a stable sweep, she comments that humility has saved entire kingdoms that the proud have all but led to ruin. Not wrong, actually. I think that's a very good statement. Isildur says he's trying to get away from Numenor, saying that what they have left behind is not the real Numenor, which he doubts ever existed. But Galadriel assured him that it did and does, if only in the heart of a stable sweep, she says. Isildur introduces himself and Galadriel recognizes his father in him. Isildur says he was always told that he looked like his mother. And he's thrilled to see sunrise over Middle-earth. When his father appears, Isildur returns to the stables and Elendil tells Galadriel that his wife drowned at sea. So back to that comment there about humility saving entire kingdoms, the proud have all but led to ruin. And of course, we have to remember just how far back Galadriel's memory goes. So which kingdoms might Galadriel be thinking of that were saved through humility? Beleriand?
Yeah, Beleriand as a whole was never really considered a kingdom. And of course, it wasn't saved. So
right.
That kind of doesn't work too well. Gondolin kind of came to mind for me, although, of course, in the end, it fell too. That decision to retreat and to hide might be considered a form of humility, of recognition that, you know, we really can't defeat this Vala. So let's do the next best thing because, you know, we're exiled now. We're here. And we want to preserve, you know, our lives and our fellows and our culture, whatever, as long as possible. Rather than do the whole booyah, we can beat this dude and run out there and get killed.
So could we, I mean, obviously this is a long way in the future to the Galadriel and, you know, she has memory, but she doesn't have this kind of foresight. If we push this forward into the time of the Lord of the Rings, we could possibly say that the humility of Sam and Frodo in taking on the burden of the ring, that does save entire kingdoms. And that the pride of certain other leaders, like Saruman, like Denethor, have all but led to ruin. So there is I think that we can point to that as saying it's true. She doesn't know this because it hasn't happened yet.
Right, right.
But here is a thing that we can say, because the very smallest, of course, can make the biggest difference.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'd love to grant Galadriel that kind of prescience. It may just be more of a proverb or something. I don't know. And certainly in Valinor, there was no need for saving of kingdoms because, you know. Or maybe, now here's a thought. What about the very, very first land that they had with the two lamps? That wasn't exactly a kingdom. And I don't know that you could accuse them of being prideful when they made the two lamps. And then when they go and hide behind the walls of the mountains that they themselves create, is that more of a form of humility as well? I don't know.
Looking at that, we can also say that, you know, if we want to point to the really proud, we point to Fëanor. And he all but led to ruin the vast majority of his people. Passed it down to his sons. Right.
Yeah. No, that piece of it I don't have any trouble with. There's plenty of examples in her life already of the proud all but leading places to ruin.
It's the humility bit.
Saving kingdoms.
Yeah.
That was the one which, you know, gives it balance. And I don't know. Maybe she just came up with something in the moment to comfort a stable sweep, as she thought. Shall we move on?
Yes, let's move on. Do you want to do the next bit?
I will. Back in the village, Arondir tells Bronwyn that he cannot destroy the sword hilt that Théo found, and so he will hide it. But Théo is watching the whole exchange. The villagers prepare for war, and Bronwyn and Arondir give a traditional speech to encourage their fighters. Bronwyn tells Théo she needs him in the tavern to protect those who cannot fight for themselves. Théo asks her to repeat what she used to say to him after his bad dreams. And she replies, "In the end, the shadow is a small and passing thing. There is light and high beauty forever beyond its reach. Find the light, and the shadow will not find you." They embrace. He says farewell to her and goes to join the others entering the tavern. Arondir takes out two of the Alfirin seeds that Bronwyn gave him and says that this is a tradition among elves to plant one before the battle begins. Bronwyn responds, "New life and defiance of death?" Arondir tells her about the Vala who protects all growing things and those who tend them. He says that they will plant the rest of the seeds after the battle is over in a new garden, he and Bronwyn and Théo together. Bronwyn asks for his promise, and he kisses her. Now, this clearly is a reflection of what we saw Adar do. It was at the beginning of the episode. But why do you suppose it's Bronwyn who says this ritual phrase, new life and defiance of death? I mean, she's saying it as a question, but she's using exactly the same language.
Yes. What and I have to say, this? That totally confused me when I saw this.
Thank you.
Right? Because... it would not have surprised me quite as much if Arondir had said it, because then you could see how it was a saying that had been passed down through elven generations, if you like. But for Bronwyn to say it, that kind of didn't make sense to me, especially as it's exactly the same language that Adar uses. How would she have that same phrase unless another elf had said it to her before? But it doesn't feel like that, because Arondir actually then tells her about the tradition of planting the seeds before battle. Mm. So it doesn't sound like it's something that she knew about beforehand. So hence my confusion. I'd love to say I've got, here is my answer. But I don't actually have an answer for that.
Yeah. Yeah. She says it in response to him explaining the tradition. And it comes to her, it seems, spontaneously, because she ends it as a question. New life in defiance of death, meaning, is this why you do this? Is this the meaning of the ritual?
But that she has the same language exactly as Adar.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know why.
Very odd. Which led me to then also wonder, well, I'm skipping ahead a little bit. Why are they trying to tie this connection between Adar and Arondir? And is it, you know, something all elves know? Because clearly they are not the same type of elf, if you will, for lack of a better word, meaning they come from different clans that have had different experiences, you know, Arondir being a Sylvan elf and Adar being, we don't quite know what, but certainly older.
Very much so. And I doubt a Sylvan elf. As well. Something,
I don't think so.
No, there's something that tells me he's not a Sylvan elf.
He could well come from the time before there were actually three groupings of elves. You know, he could come from the very, very early days at Quivienden. So that's always been my headcanon.
But the good headcanon until it's proved otherwise.
Well, exactly. True of most headcanon, right? This may have just been a poetic license kind of thing from the scriptwriters. And, you know, well, I have a theory, but I'll introduce that after we look more in detail at all of the rituals that we see in this section. So first of all, we have the encouragement speech.
Yeah, which is obviously a reflection of the one that we get from Adar and the orcs earlier.
Right, right. And something that I think is probably a ritual in just about any culture you care to think of, at least those who engage in warfare. What about the ritual for Theo when he wakes up after? I was getting a little verklempt there while I was reading it. Because, of course, I can't help but think of Sam looking up in Mordor and seeing Erendil.
That's exactly what I thought of when I heard it, yes.
Yeah, yeah. But also, she adds her own statement, find the light and the shadow will not find you. Which certainly fits in nicely, but that is I think, unique to her and to the scriptwriters. But never having had children, I can't speak to how it feels as a parent to know that they're having nightmares and going and waking and comforting them. But expect that most parents will have done this ritual at least once. And you have each having their own particular phrase, maybe one for each of their children, because, of course, children are different and different things will comfort them.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, as a parent myself, yes, I did deal with bad dreams that my daughter had when she was little. The language of what Bronwyn says here is a little highfalutin for a little kid.
Good point.
The sense of it.
Good point.
Yes. The idea that let's turn on the light and show you that there are no monsters under the bed. There are no monsters because we shine a light and we see there aren't any, but I'm right here. Mm-hmm. If there were, they wouldn't get past me. You give it that kind of sense, that reassurance that, yeah, mum and dad are here and there's no monsters because they're not allowed. But this kind of language is, it's a little, like I said, a little highfalutin for a little one. So it depends on how old Theo was when she started to say these kinds of things. Because, of course, the language that you use when your kid wakes up squealing at age 3 or 4 is very different to the language that you use when your kid wakes up squealing at age 10.
Yeah, mummy's here.
Yep, yeah. Exactly. When they're really little, they just need to know that they are fully awake and that mum and or dad are right there and it's okay.
Yeah, yeah. Parenting takes incredible courage, I have to say.
Won't disagree.
I picture myself trying to make that promise to a child, you know, as long as I'm here, nothing can hurt you. There's a part of me that just knows that's not true.
Trouble is, the parent does too, really.
That's what I mean. No, yep. I mean, I as the parent would know this. Yep. The child might believe me. I would hope the child would believe me, that would certainly be my intention. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, no, if an axe wielder comes in, I don't have a lot of resources to deal with it. On the other hand, the odds of that happening are
so low.
fairly slim, at least in our 21st century day-to-day lives.
Right, so, yes. Slightly in different, Theo's I suppose,
life,
there.
In Theo's life, I don't know. Axe-wielding mad people could actually be a thing.
They could indeed. Yeah, but you're right. I mean, as parents, we make all manner of promises to our children, but we do it in the moment because we really don't need to sit the kid down and say, well, you know, I'll tell you this now, but let's face it, if there was an axe-wielding murderer came through the door, I wouldn't be able to save you. So, I mean, you don't need to go through that with your kid.
Right.
So, yeah, sometimes we make these statements and the adult in us knows that there's a limit to it, but the kid does not know that and does not need to know that.
No.
But you make that promise because, frankly, when you have a child, that's what comes with that is, you know, especially when your kid is little, you are their everything. And you have to step up and be that, even through all of the fear and lack of confidence and all that kind of thing, because, you know, you can read all manner of books on parenting, but not one of them is any use in the moment.
No, you can't say, just hold on while I go look at my bookshelf. And it would be my devout wish that when the day eventually comes that the child realizes, actually, there are some things that my parents can't protect me from, they'll be old enough to be able to take in the information and you know, accept it, cope with it, deal with
yes.
it, not feel betrayed. You told me you'd always take, you know, but doesn't always happen when you want it to, does it?
No, it doesn't. And it, of course, it changes year on year as the child gets older year on year, because, of course, by the time they reach a certain age, it's no longer about monsters in the closet or under the bed.
No.
It's about the difficulties that they're facing on, you know, when they go to school or something like that.
Right. Yeah. Very real things.
Real, real things.
You
yeah.
I mean, wish for the axe murderer instead.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, let's face it, we don't have this problem here in the UK, but in the US, so many children having to do active shooter drills,
you know,
that horrifies me and upsets me, because little children learning how they have to hide in case somebody comes in with a gun. I mean, this is a real thing in the States.
It certainly is. And it horrifies and affects most of us, if not all of us.
Yeah. So I know we've gone slightly off track, same thing, because we're examining Bronwyn as a parent here, I suppose, and doing ritualistic things that parents do to reassure their child. And I find it interesting that in this moment where, you know, they're waiting for battle to begin, if you like, Theo reaches for a childhood memory.
Yes, I noticed that too. Well, in part, I think, because while Bronwyn has given him something that he can hold to himself to maintain his pride and his dignity, they both know the reason why he's in the tavern is because he's too young.
Mm.
In Bronwyn's eyes.
Yes.
Now, of course, we later find out that's not really true. And it could just be, and I'm not applying any blame to her, goodness knows, it could just be she couldn't bear the thought of Theo getting killed. And so she puts him in the safest place she can think of and gives him a job. And also says, yeah, well, you can fight. That's true. They can't, and they need somebody who can. And so that's why I want you there. But, and it's also could be sort of a, well, that's one less thing for me to worry about if I know that my
son
is tucked up safely somewhere, because I have plenty of other things to worry about at this point.
Yes, definitely.
So what I found interesting to look at too in all of this is, in essence, we have just seen two very different groups of beings go through exactly the same rituals in preparation for battle. So do you think that Payne and McKay are saying anything in particular to us?
Well, I think so. I mean, it's a deliberate mirroring. And there's actually
A
lot of this deliberate mirroring in this particular episode.
Yeah, say more.
Yeah. So, yes, I think they are. I think they're telling us that, in essence, it doesn't matter what side you're on, it's the same preparation for battle, because there are living creatures, people, whatever we want to call them, on both sides. And that speaks back, of course, to any war in our primary world, because the way in which you get soldiers to fight is by telling them that the other side are bad, evil, wrong, the
inhuman enemy.
Yeah.
Inhuman.
Exactly. And the more you dehumanize them, the easier it is for the soldiers on your side to kill them. Meanwhile, on the other side, the leaders are telling the soldiers exactly the same thing about you.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Because for most of us, it is not natural to head out to battle and kill as many people as you can. It's not a natural thing to do. It's a thing that most of us would only do if we absolutely had to. I mean, I'm aware there are some people out here who would probably enjoy it because that's the kind of person that they are, but they're a minority. The vast majority of us would only do that if it became absolutely necessary.
Yeah.
And so you have to distance yourself or be made to distance yourself in some way, so that it becomes easier, I suppose.
Well, and for those who choose the military as a career out of a desire to ensure that their country is safe and to protect it and so forth, I'm not going to subscribe to the notion that they come to a place where they can't wait to kill other people.
No, the vast majority would not. But there will be some, but the vast majority are not.
I remember a wonderful scene from C.S. Lewis's book, Till We Have Faces, where a lifelong soldier character tells a young girl who is going to become their queen. She's very skilled in battle. She uses her sword wonderfully. Her name is Orwell. And when they've worked and worked and worked, she's going to be fighting one-on-one with the leader of the other people. And they've agreed to, you know, have this combat decide who wins, quote unquote. And he says to her, okay, now we've perfected that fault that you had, but before we go, there's one more thing. You have to kill the pig. Because there is something in every human being that will resist killing another human being, certainly and possibly another living creature. And you have to not hesitate. Because if you do, you're probably dead.
Mm.
And so we have to overcome that resistance. And so you have to kill the pig that we'll be using for your victory feast later on, kind of thing. And I was so glad that he mentioned that. Of course, he fought in World War I, as did Tolkien, and acknowledged and recognized that there is something in human beings that do resist that. And depending upon your life experience, that resistance may stay with you your whole life, or it may be ground away through various horrible experiences. But I have to think that anyone who does serve in the military has had some kind of training or discussion or something. I mean, it's a lot more impersonalized now, of course. You're sending out drones or pushing buttons or whatever, rather than facing another person at the end of a sword. But I have to think and believe that there is still this hesitancy that is part of the training of somebody who has chosen this for their life's work, whether military or police force or, you know, whatever you might want to mention.
Yeah, so bringing it back to what Payne and McKay are doing, I think by giving us those parallels, by giving us that mirroring in the episode, is it showing us that in the end, two sides are going to come together with that same need to be put to, you know, the moment where they're going to draw swords and actually fight.
Right.
Now, of course, we can then argue that orcs are a little bit more likely to want to go to battle, but even they are encouraged and they're marched off and they're shouting their war cries and things like that because, you know, even they have to be kept up to the scratch, if you like. And by having that mirroring, I think Payne and McKay are just showing us that in the end, there's a lot of similarities between the two sides. One of the things I like about this series is that they do things that are far more interesting with the orcs than I have seen in other adaptations.
Yes.
You know, the orcs are, I hesitate to use the word, but you know what I mean, humanized a little bit more. They're not depicted as the mindless grunting hordes. I mean, yes, they grunt, but they grunt respectfully, remember?
Exactly.
That's a thing. But they're not portrayed as just simply an amorphous mass. That they have an orc community, that they have this leader who they clearly love. And who has that a love for them. I wouldn't say it's a particularly healthy father-child relationship, but you know, it certainly has a little bit more to it than we've seen in other adaptations. So that's one of the things I think is quite interesting about this adaptation.
Yeah, and you mentioned the word community again, and as we say, ritual builds community. What I see is the overarching message is you need to fight as one.
Yes.
You are a group now. You must operate as a group and fight as a group and be for each other and so forth. So even more than the, you know, because I don't see villagers saying, yeah, I can't wait to stab those orcs. but they are encouraged to say, yes, we can overcome this challenge. We can see the sunrise tomorrow.
Right.
And the emphasis there being on we.
On we.
Okay, so let's commence the battle here.
Okay, and indeed the battle commences. And after a difficult fight, the villagers triumph over the orcs. But I have to say, this is one of the most shocking moments, actually.
I agree.
Their joy is short-lived as they discover that most of those that they fought against and killed, they're not orcs at all. They were the villagers who had joined the orcs with Waldreg. At that moment when they first start taking off the helmets and seeing who it is that they've killed is just awful. Then the remaining orc army attacks a second time with arrows. So clearly the villagers have been sent in just as cannon fodder, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And the remaining villagers have to withdraw into the tavern. Bronwyn is shot, but with a combination of her knowledge, Theo's help, Arondir's skill, and Alfirin's seeds, they're able to save her. The orcs break into the tavern and Adar enters. He demands the hilt from Arondir, who says, let them go and then I will consider it. Adar orders the orcs to start killing villagers and then threatens Bronwyn's life. But Theo, who has known all along where the hilt was hidden, gives it to Adar just as we hear the arrival of the Numenorean cavalry. And Adar gives the hilt to Waldreg, telling him that he has a task for him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's that, yeah, that moment with Adar in the hut. This is why I really love Adar's character, because you can feel sympathy for him in one moment.
Yes.
And interest in another moment, and then revulsion in another moment.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? When he simply has villagers killed, just as if it's nothing. Because to him, it doesn't seem to be anything at all. Mm-hmm. Yes, he has an agenda. He wants a homeland for him and his orc children. Mm-hmm. But he's quite prepared to do whatever it takes to get this. And he will see the slaughter of innocent people without a blink.
Yeah. Well, possibly because he doesn't see them as innocent. He sees them as, colonizers or whatever. Mm. Yeah. Yeah, his first priority, as you say, is always for his Uruk children. And in some respects, that complication of his character, I think, is what makes him closer to human. Because we humans are complicated creatures.
Oh, yes.
And we are a mixture. And we don't always like to be reminded of that.
Very true.
So it may be that this is why some people are really uncomfortable with the character of Adar and what the showrunners appear to be doing with the orcs to make them more complicated and so forth. You know, some people just want their baddies to be baddies and their goodies to be goodies. And there is some degree of comfort in that, but it's even more fantastical than, you know, fantasy literature generally, I think. And Tolkien didn't do that either. And
no,
I think that's another reason why I really like the fact that they take this approach.
Right, because for Tolkien, good and bad do not exist on a well-delineated binary.
No.
The most interesting characters always have that fuzzy boundary between the two anyway.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But there can be good in the bad and bad in the good.
Mm-hmm. And even more, he doesn't believe in evil which exists independently of anything. He follows the Boethian line that says evil is the absence of good.
Right.
Evil's the result of good making poor choices.
Right. Yes.
A lot easier to see that in this kind of a depiction.
Yes. He says in one of his letters, doesn't he, that I do not believe in absolute evil because that would be zero.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, so the last bit of this section, Isildur goes down to the battle and he arrives in time to help his father, but it is Halbrand who saves Elendil. Galadriel asks Arondir where the commander of the orcs is, and he points to Adar escaping on horseback. She follows swiftly on, and Theo watches her leave with adoration. He's got a teenage crush.
Oh, you betcha. The look on his face is like,
Who could blame him? You know?
No, it's Galadriel. Totally.
Yeah.
And she's doing all these amazing actions on horseback.
But she's a little old for him, let's face it.
drop-dead gorgeous. Well, he didn't know that.
No.
I also don't think that he would even dream of considering her in light of that particular sort of relationship. But
oh, no, it's an adoration, isn't it?
It is. Actually, it reminds me of what Faramir said to Eowyn about her first reaction to Aragorn, you know,
yes.
as a young soldier looking at a...
At this puissant leader.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Which she is every bit of puissant. So we're going to do something a little different right now and drop one of our pieces of feedback into the middle of our discussion today because it is very pertinent to what we've been talking about. This is from Brian8063 from the Lorehounds community. Hello, Marilyn and Sarah. Thank you for the insightful podcast on the relationship between the show and and ritual. It is a thought-provoking discussion that I thoroughly enjoy. Thank you, Brian. I appreciate those kind words, and I'm so glad that you're enjoying it. He goes on, I wanted to ask this. Does battle intensify a ritual? I'm reflecting on soldiers and the many rituals that they have. The intense situation, the knowledge that soldiers could be maimed or die, probably brings the need to add ritual to their lives. We see a pretty intense one in episode 1 when the elves lay down their swords. I wonder if orcs have more rituals than we realize. They tend to be seen in a simplistic manner, but I remember one scene in one of the Peter Jackson films in which an orc was screaming right before his death. This is emotion. As we see more battles in the show, we can see what happens. Thanks again, Brian8063. Well, Brian, I hope that you saw some of what you were asking about reflected in our discussions today, because that's been a lot of the bulk of what we've been talking about today. I don't see how battle doesn't intensify everything.
Right.
And I think that's part of the training that one has to have, is to not let that intensity interfere with your training and your
right.
discipline and your clear sight of the situation as it unfolds.
Right. So, I mean, that's where I would say the question, does battle intensify a ritual, may not be quite the wording. Does battle produce more rituals? That maybe I could go along with, because battle itself is intense. We can agree on that. Mm-hmm. The rituals that come along with battle will necessarily be intense because they have to maintain that intensity for the soldiers to go into battle. But because the ritual is formed in order to be connected to the idea of going into battle, it's already an intense thing. Does battle intensify it further? I'm not sure if that's the way it works. The ritual intensifies the feelings, the emotions within the fighter. So maybe it's kind of the other way around. I mean, the other thing I'm thinking is that it's not just soldiers going into battle that tend to have these kinds of rituals. We also see this in like sports people who, before they go on to whatever it is, a pitch or a court or, you know, non-sporty person here, insert your area or arena as you wish. Often they will have their own rituals, like tying up the left shoe before the right shoe, or, you know, things
yes.
like, which is all about readying them for the moment. And it's not battle as such, in the sense of hopefully they're not going out there to literally kill anybody, but it is a fight of some kind because you're going out there to win. That's the
yes.
whole point,
yes.
right?
Yes.
But to me, the ritual is part of preparation rather than the battle itself intensifying the ritual. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah, it does. It does. I'm looking a little further down, and I think maybe this was part of what he was asking. He says, the intense situation, which you were just describing, probably brings the need to add ritual to their lives.
Mm-hmm.
So you just mentioned the tying one shoelace before the other. And what comes to mind for me when I hear that is luck.
Yes.
You're appealing to luck through, okay, the first time I did this left shoe first and then the right shoe and I won. So I'm going to do it that way from now on.
Mm-hmm.
Is that ritual? I suppose it is.
I think so.
It's a personal ritual. You're repeating it. You're doing it with the intention of bringing about a specific outcome. So it tends to tick off all of our criteria quite nicely. And I'm wondering if it does so in part without people even meaning to. You know, I don't think one would sit down and think, now how many rituals can I create before this first battle? But they evolve sort of organically for individuals. Now for a group, like the elves laying down their swords, as he mentioned from the very first episode, that to me was clearly not spontaneous. It was practiced. It was agreed upon. It was something that they all knew. And it was a ritual ending of the relationship between the soldier and the commander, right?
Right.
So you have your individual rituals in advance of battle or conflict or competition or whatever. But then you have your group rituals, which are designed, as I said before, to form coherence within the community. So I think maybe that touches on both of the points that Brian was making here. And I think individual fighters' rituals will change over time as their experience changes too. But it wouldn't surprise me, I guess, is my short answer.
Right.
I think these particular orcs probably have more rituals than we realize. I don't know if Peter Jackson's orcs have more rituals. I don't know what's become of them over the, you know, between the Second Age and the Third Age. And we do know from the texts that by the time we get to the Third Age, most of the orcs in Mordor were formed in some fashion by Sauron.
Right.
So I think he would probably almost certainly build in some differences, because he's not looking to make children. He's looking to make cannon fodder.
Right.
In my estimation.
Mindless soldiers who will do as they're told.
And don't really care, you know, how they treat people or, you know, cultural values or any of those other things. But, and I think the one you're talking about, that one scene where we see the orc screaming right before his death, I think that was the orc in the charge of the Rohirrim on the Battle of Pelennor Fields, that he had a sort of a leather cap that almost made a kind of a hood over him. And he was, I think he had his big bushy beard or something. Anyway, I just remember this face and this, oh, which was almost sort of an aria kind of, it had this lovely tonal curve to it. I think that's the work he was thinking about. Brian, if it wasn't, you can write in and let us know. But thank you very much for your feedback and for
that
your
was
question.
A great question.
Excellent question. I agree.
Okay. Marilyn, do you want to pick up where we left off?
I will do that. With the invention of Halbrand, Adar is halted in his flight. Halbrand asks if he recognizes him, and Adar says no, asking him if he killed someone that Halbrand loved. Galadriel intervenes to prevent Halbrand from killing Adar outright, saying she needs him alive. She tells Halbrand that one cannot satisfy thirst by drinking seawater. Meanwhile, Isildur and his friends are talking about possible next steps, while Galadriel questions Adar. He denies being Sauron and claims to have killed him by splitting him open, after Sauron killed too many of his Uruk children trying to claim craft, a power not of the flesh, but over flesh, a power of the unseen world. Adar claims that his children are free, children of the One, as worthy of life as any other, and that, quote, soon this land will be ours and then you will understand, close quote. Galadriel vows genocide on Adar's children while keeping him alive to witness it all. Adar says he is not the only elf whose life has been transformed by the darkness, and suggests that she search for Morgoth's successor in her own mirror.
That was a moment.
This time it is Halbrand who stops Galadriel from killing Adar. As they leave, Adar asks Halbrand who he is, but Halbrand walks away without replying. Boy, there's a lot of mirroring in there, I just realized.
Oh, yes.
You were talking about that before, and I'm like, oh, yeah, there it is. Look, first she saves him, then he saves her. You know, just really back and forth. And interesting, because, of course, the implication could be one of them anyway, that, you know, they're a lot more alike than they're different.
And that is the implication for sure.
Yeah, Galadriel and Halbrand, but also Galadriel and Adar.
Indeed. And when Adar says, search for Morgoth's successor in your own mirror, That's really interesting because of the way in which they are depicting Galadriel in this moment. I know there's been a lot of criticism of this depiction of Galadriel. And I would point people to the fact that this is a Galadriel thousands of years before the Galadriel of Lothlorien that we meet in The Lord of the Rings. And everybody gets to have learning moments, especially in a very, very long life. And she's been through a lot. And the fact that there's darkness in her, that is not a surprise to me at all, actually, because we do not reach the wisdom that she does by the time she is the Lady of the Woods without going through some stuff. And read the unfinished tales. And in that, there's quite a lot of detail about Galadriel being quite martial and athletic and strong and forward. And that's not the Galadriel that we see as the Lady of the Woods either. So somewhere along the line, it has eased into the great wise elf that we see in the Third Age. This is the Second Age. It's a long time before that.
Yeah, somewhere Galadriel is referred to as the greatest of Noldor, even greater than Feanor.
Yeah.
And that is saying an awful lot in this world. The other piece of this world, and we see this in many different examples, as in our own world, wisdom comes through suffering. And right now, she's carrying the darkness of her grief and her loss, which nobody has offered to share with her how to deal with that. And so she's taken on the only things she knows, which is the fighting and the martial prowess and the making absolutely certain that every single last sign of Sauron and Sauron himself are eliminated. And, oh, by the way, that includes any of the orcs. Even though these orcs, these Uruk, have nothing to do with Sauron, it seems. I mean, we're having hints dropped all along the way here. But it's clear. I mean, she spent time with Melian, the Maia. And Melian spent time in Lorien. But she did not spend time with Nianna, as Gandalf did. And so, thus far, I don't know that she's had anybody to teach her how to grieve, how to find pity, how to express patience, and how to live with patience. All she's doing is what she knows.
Yes. That makes good sense.
And she realizes that eventually. And at one point she says, you know, Halbrand asks her, why do you keep fighting? And she says, because I cannot stop. And earlier Elrond had asked her, you know, or said to her, told her, put up your sword. And her response is, without it, who am I to be? Mm. That's scary.
Yes, it is.
That is very dark. So in that sense of darkness, Adar is not wrong. But in the sense of darkness, it says, I'm going to slaughter whoever I need to create a homeland for myself. No, I don't see that in her. She's provoked to making an expression of genocide. And when Adar points it out to her, she is horrified. Now, her initial reaction is to stab the person who is telling her that. And isn't that always the case? When someone tells you a truth you really don't want to hear, often your first response is to want to slap the teller.
Yes.
And that's a very good sign that what they're telling you is truth.
Yes. Because it challenges you and you recognize that, ouch, that hurts. But it can only hurt if there is that grain of truth in there.
Yeah.
If it doesn't connect with you at all, then you can brush it off.
Yeah. Or laugh out loud. Are you kidding me? What? No. Not even close.
Okay, shall I carry on?
Do, please.
Okay. Galadriel and Halbrand go and sit in the forest near a stream and agree that they each felt something while they were riding together. Galadriel thanks Halbrand for pulling her back, and he says she pulled him back first. She tells Halbrand to be free of whatever was done to him and whatever he himself did. Halbrand says he never believed he could be free of what he did, but that while fighting together today, he changed his mind. Now, of course, with hindsight, that's a very interesting conversation, isn't it?
I really want to talk about this conversation in light of episode 8.
We're going to have to table it.
I think so. I mean, we did say spoilers abound everywhere, but I think for the flow of our particular approach, we'll put a pin in that for the time.
We'll put a pin in it, but we are coming back to that.
Oh, you betcha.
So at the celebrations of the victory, Bronwyn is presented to the Queen Regent, who says she understands something of what it is to be a fine leader who never sought to take up the burden. Myriel salutes Halbrand as King of the Southlands, and all the people do likewise. When Bronwyn notices the sigil on the pouch that he wears, she asks Halbrand if he is the king that they were promised. He says yes, and the villagers toast their returned king. Again, sticking a pin in it.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And notice we do have some rituals here. I didn't actually pull them out, but you know, the toasting of the king and the declaring and the affirmation of the people and all that. You know, you'd recognize that from any number of Anglo-Saxon or other, you know, rulers proclaimed by acclamation rather than by inheritance or, you know, having just won the battle and so forth. Yeah, we really don't see him doing a whole lot in the battle. Like, well, he saves Elendil and he chases after Adar, but they don't ever really show him fighting, which, okay, fine. You know, they wanted to highlight the Numenoreans because this is their big moment, right?
Right. Okay, I think you can carry on there, then.
I will do that. When Arondir gives Theo the wrapped package of the sword hilt, after telling him not to blame himself for choosing to save his mother's life, Theo says that even now he feels the loss of it because, quote, when it was in my hands, I felt powerful. Let's put a pin in this one, too, friends. Arondir tells Theo to give it to the Numenoreans to be tossed into the sea. Theo recognizes instantly when he holds it that the package does not contain the sword hilt, because it is the wrong weight and length. Back at the ruined tower, Waldreg uses the now flaming sword to release the waters dammed behind the tower. They run through the various tunnels and trenches dug by the orcs to flow into Mount Orodruin. Beric senses the pending disaster, and Isildur tries to calm him. But only Elendil is able to do so. He tells him that Beric is distressed by Isildur's pain. Numenorean horses and riders bond together so they can feel each other's moods. Elendil tells Isildur that he learned all this from his mother, and the two are reconciled as Isildur asks if Elendil could teach him. Then suddenly water begins to spurt up through holes from the tunnels, and as it reaches Orodruin, it triggers an explosive eruption. Both Galadriel and Arondir hold up their hands against the force of the blast, but chaos ensues. Stunned, Galadriel stares at the oncoming pyroclastic flow, which engulfs her as the screen goes dark.
Well then.
Yes, I'm going to apologize to John Lorehound for saying one more time pyroclastic flow, because he absolutely came to loathe the term, but I just think it's cool. I love to say it feels nice in my mouth. So apologies, John.
Sorry, not sorry.
Sorry, not sorry. That's it. That's absolutely it.
Okay. Well, I mean, it's a heck of a moment.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know what? I didn't even notice this. This most recent rewatch was the first time I noticed that in the immediate aftermath of the initial explosion, you know, there was that one energy wave. I don't know what that's called, so don't worry. But I had never noticed before, Galadriel does hold up her hand.
Yes.
And then shortly after that, we see Arondir, who had kind of crouched over, but he was also holding up his hand. And I thought, by golly, they're shielding.
Mm-hmm.
They're both using some sort of similar elvish technique to mitigate the force of the blast. I'd never seen that before.
No. And there's no explanation given as or how.
I mean, maybe it is just an instinctive gesture to hold up your hands against some kind of, but for Galadriel, she was standing absolutely straight and still and staring at it. And it wasn't a crouch and a protect me kind of a thing. It was, she just held up her hand. So I don't know. Listeners, write in.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us what you think.
I think we've mined the episode for as much as we possibly can in terms of ritual, haven't we?
Well, particularly since we have a whole lot of feedback today and we don't want to run for 3 hours. So we're not going to do that, folks. But we are going to take a break again. And when we come back, we'll be hearing from some of you.
Excellent.
Welcome back. It's time for feedback. So our first message comes to us from Arthur Harrow. And he wrote to us, he said he couldn't find how to do that, but you can do that by writing to Rings and Rituals, all one word, at thelorehounds.com. Or if you are looking for the website, it is thelorehounds.com/podcast/rings-and-rituals. So Arthur writes, today you discussed Adar. We know his name means father, and we heard this word in the name of Eärwyn ben Adar, which is one of the names of Tom Bombadil, which means oldest and fatherless. In Hebrew, the prefix ben means son of. So if you run into Bombadil, should you say, who's your daddy?
That is so Arthur.
That is absolutely Arthur. I wanted to introduce this audience to Arthurisms. If you ever run across him or hear him, he sometimes shows up on the After Hours PPP recordings. And just prepare yourself for puns, because that seems to be Arthur's calling card.
Indeed. But here's another of my favorite people, Ed the Easterling.
Yes.
Who jumps in to say hi and to say, I've enjoyed the first two episodes. Nothing profound to add, but I greatly enjoyed the talk between Sarah and Marilyn. Thanks for that, Ed.
Thank you, Ed. We greatly enjoyed the talk between ourselves. So I'm glad to know that other people enjoy it too. Felisa says, it's like reliving the show again, which is awesome, with a magnifying glass on ritual. It really brings the show and Tolkien's world back to life. Loving your chemistry and discussions.
Aaron Kay says, I'm finishing listening to the latest R&R episode, and I love your talk about stone singing. When I'd originally watched The Rings of Power, I was enamored by this concept. The fabric of Tolkien's universe is the Song of the Ainur. As the adopted children of Eru Ilúvatar, it is only fitting that the dwarves have a method of singing that connects them more closely to the stone. Yeah, I love that.
Isn't that incredible?
Mm.
And why it never occurred to me before, I don't know. But Aaron, that's just, it's wonderful. I really, really appreciate that idea. And it will be with me from now on whenever I watch that scene. And then we hear from Abby Zefku, who says, jumping in to express my admiration and gratitude for this beautiful podcast I finally caught up with. I love your approach to the subject. I will confess that I was on the fence with it for this long time because I didn't especially love the season of Rings of Power overall, just bits here and there. But I love and rewatch yearly the Peter Jackson movies and loved the books. Hearing you both on episode one about how the elves don't feel Tolkienish, I felt vindicated. That said, your approach warms me up to getting back into the world for the new season. And of course, I am now a faithful listener of Rings and Rituals.
Lovely.
Wonderful. Thank you, Abby. Thank you, Abby. I'm glad that we've given you a way in, because I think there's always something to appreciate, at least in every adaptation I've ever seen so far. Now, you know, balanced sometimes with a lot more that I really don't appreciate, but
sure. Yeah.
As you say,
do we have things to criticize about the show? Absolutely.
Of course we do.
Yeah.
And other adaptations as well. And even the original series. I mean, come on.
Right.
There are going to be glitches everywhere.
Of course. Of course. Okay. Sub-Zero says, just listening to the beginnings pod. I could listen to your recite excerpts all day. Well, we could do that.
We can throw in some more. Yes, we did. That was when we were reading examples of rituals from Legendarium. And Sarah, I think you brought people to tears over some of the things that you were reading that were so beautiful. So, oh, the Theoden, that's what it was. You read Theoden's funeral. And,
right. And how poignant is that, given the news that we had this week?
Oh.
About the death of Bernard Hill. Oh, my goodness. I felt sad all day. I really did.
Yeah. And it's interesting that he could play a character so beautifully and inhabit it so beautifully that he, I think, at least in my mind, and I think in many people's minds, the actor will always be associated with the role.
Oh, absolutely. I every time I think of Theoden, actually, I have Bernard Hill's face in my mind.
Yeah.
Because he just seems to inhabit, if you like, the character of Theoden.
He really did.
Because, yeah, just it's just wonderful. I mean, there's a quote that I actually did put on Twitter. I refuse to call it X. On Twitter. That just sort of encapsulated this. So bear with me a second.
Of course.
And he was laid in a house of stone with his arms and many other fair things that he had possessed. And over him was raised a great mound covered with green turves of grass and of white evermind. And now there were 8 mounds on the east side of the barrow field.
Yeah.
Thank you, Bernard Hill.
Thank you, Bernard. Ferthu, Bernard, Ferthu. Here's a good question for us to discuss from, again, for Elisa. So you guys don't think Sauron, a.k.a. Halbrand, had the whole finding Galadriel on the raft and the sea monster planned?
Don't know.
So, spoilers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So, possibly.
I will step out on a limb and say that I don't think he did.
No, I don't think he did either. I can see why people might think he did, especially with spoilers. We'll get to that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Sauron was nothing if not an opportunist. And there it is canon in the literature that he did initially repent.
Yes. Yeah.
So we don't get many details of this. But we also know that when he went to Manwë's Herald and said, hey, I realized I really messed up here. Do you think you could take me back in and I'll start, you know, helping to repair everything? And the Herald said, I'm sorry, but you and I are of the same level. You got to go to the higher authority. And Sauron thought, maybe not. So, you know, take that all into consideration when you consider Sauron in the Second Age.
Okay, Meta says, thank you for the Harfoot discussion in this newest episode. This is a discussion I've been looking forward to, thinking the Harfoots were judged a little too harshly by some. I've been wondering whether the Stranger will also teach them more pity. If he is who we think he probably shouldn't be, he would have learned that himself from Nienna. That's a whole conversation.
I think it's very, very tactfully expressed too.
I think so too. That might then be a part of what softens some of their practices and teaches them other ways of doing things that don't lower their survival rates. Also, one practical question for your podcast. Will you do some episodes after you finish talking through the series where you focus on one storyline at a time? The disadvantage of going episode by episode is that you have to put a pin in a lot of things along the way, like we had to today.
Just 2 minutes ago, right?
A couple of episodes at the end could be a nice way of gathering all of these together, and it would mean more time listening to the two of you, which would also be a plus. Well, that's lovely, and I don't see why not.
Thank you, Mitch. Sure, we can certainly add that to the list. We do have one bonus episode about music, which will appear at some point in the not-too-distant future. But it could be very interesting to
pick up a thread.
Pick a thread and follow it all the way through and see what that reveals. Yeah. So thank you. We will definitely take that under advisement. And then follow up. I also want to stress that I'm really enjoying the episodes as they are. The suggestion is also just a way to stretch out the fun. You just don't want the story to be over, Metcha, is that it?
Something like that, yes.
Something along those lines.
And Brian, 8063, who, of course, we read out his question earlier, which we were debating, he says, the podcast is a masterclass. Well done and so much to learn. Thank you, Brian.
Thank you, Brian.
Yeah, that's really lovely.
I mean, you take two teachers and you put them together and, you know, two professorial types. And
and you either get this or you get chaos. And I'm not sure which one we're getting today.
Sometimes a little bit of both. Oh, here's your favorite name, Two Kids, Two Dogs. Hi, Marilyn and Sarah. Just finished watching, listening to episodes 2 and 3. I was struck how I totally missed the rituals practiced by the orcs at the end of episode 3. I have to wonder if I just had some kind of blinders on, thinking that they were too brutal beings to be capable of rituals. Also, I know that Tolkien later in life questioned whether orcs were originally elves. But I thought it was very interesting that they used the elvish word for father as if former elves, this is what they would think of or name a daughter.
Yeah, we discussed, didn't we, about orcs having rituals just in this episode.
Yeah.
But we could be here for an hour talking about all the different versions of where do orcs come from that Tolkien actually came up with.
Definitely. Definitely. He wrestled with that one almost to the end of his life. It was one of the last writings that he did was about orcs and where do they come from. And then my fellow Vala, Jean, who does a lot of co-hosting of podcasts with various lorehounds, writes, great pod, really. And, you know, as one who does them, I highly value your feedback that way, Jean, so thank you. In episode 2, when Sarah talks about the importance of strength and endurance in dwarven culture, made me think how the show tells us that those traits are also important to the Harfoots, vastly different cultures as they are. As well, but for quite different reasons, as shown when it's questioned whether Nori's father can make the journey or not. And then Elysia, another Vala, who hosts more podcasts than I can name, chimes in with Jean and says, great point.
Yeah, the dwarves have often fascinated me. I've written and spoken before about dwarf women, which I think because of their absence in the texts, it's one of the things I really love about Deesa. One of the many, many things I love about Deesa.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. It's hard not to love her.
Right.
And my first thought here is every culture requires strength and endurance.
Yes.
What differs is how do you demonstrate that? How are you tested? What sorts of ways do you find to deal with that?
Yeah. Because each culture faces its own difficulties and they're often very specific to that culture. And it's what you do with that, as you say, how you respond to it. Often that then tells us a lot more about their culture, right?
Yeah. But sometimes it tells us a little bit about ourselves because, well, I might not respond that way.
Right.
But you're not of their culture.
Right.
And that's what really leads, I think, to, you know, deeper understanding. And, you know, another interesting question to ask is, well, what would I do if I were in that situation and in that condition and so on and so on?
Excellent point.
Yeah.
Okay, Davy Mack says, I thoroughly enjoyed episode 3. The Harfoot rituals discussed as well as Adar are the two things I responded to most when the show was airing. So it was fun listening to you both talking about it. And I appreciate you reading out my message on the show. You are very welcome.
Well, of course, Davy Mack.
Yes. Looking forward to the next one. Oh, and back on first episode, you both talked about birthdays. And there was also feedback on this latest episode about birthday cakes. And it reminded me that I was going to send in feedback about birthdays among my Filipino colleagues here in Japan that I found really unique and different to the way I'm used to celebrating in the States. I just never got around to sending it in. Get around to sending it in.
Absolutely. What a teaser. Come on, David.
Yeah, you can't leave us on the edge of our seats like that.
Tell us. And then again from Aaron Kay. I have just started the Adar episode and I'm super excited for this one. This is my favorite episode of Rings of Power. I have been recommending Rings and Rituals to every Tolkien fan I know. You guys are killing it. Thank you, Aaron. Yay. I will put in a little plug here and say, you know, word of mouth, one of the best ways you can support us. So,
oh, yes.
do what Aaron does, who, by the way, is a member of the Dunedain, so you know that he's good. The Dunedain are the wonderful folks who serve as mods for the Discord channel. So
wonderful. And thank you for everything that you do to help keep Discord channels clean and safe for the rest of us.
Yes. Yes. Thank you very, very much. I'm really interested how many people commented that episode 3 was their favorite, because I think I remember saying that episode 3 was what decided me to do this whole podcast in the first place. So, showrunners and scriptwriters, please take note.
Yes, absolutely. You heard it here first. Listen to us.
So that's it for this episode. Write in and let us know what you think, any suggestions you might have for rituals for us to talk about, and anything else you'd like to share with us, including the recipes for birthday cakes of Filipinos.
Yes, absolutely.
We welcome your feedback at ringsandrituals@thelorehounds.com. or on the Lorehounds Discord server, where we have a special channel set up just for rings and rituals.
On the Lorehounds website, there's also a contact form and a voicemail feature, so look for the Contact Us link at the bottom of the page. We're aiming to publish 2 episodes a month, but if you follow any of the Lorehounds podcasts, you'll hear our ads, and they'll let you know when the next episode is approaching.
Also, be sure to check out the other podcasts supported by the Barovian Broadcasting Network. There's the Properly Howard Movie Review with Steve and Anthony, who are currently reviewing various films under the category of felonies and fugazis. Mm. No, I didn't know what a fugazi was either. Best equivalent, I think, is snafu.
Oh,
you know,
okay.
If you spell it all out, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And if that isn't clear, well, just go listen to the podcast and you'll find out. Alicia is doing Wool Shift Dust. But her latest podcast venture, which I've listened to the first couple episodes, and it's really good, the Star Wars Canon Timeline Podcast. If you are like me, totally confused about the books and the video games and the in-canon and the out-canon, all that melange that is the Star Wars universe, this is your podcast. Go ahead and give it a listen, and some things at least will be untangled. There is a lot more than I could really cope with at one time, but you know, you can always re-listen if you want to. And of course, we have John and David on the main Lorehounds podcast. They're currently reviewing season 1 of The House of the Dragon in advance of season 2 coming along in June, along with all kinds of other goodnesses. Links for all of these are in the show notes.
So our thanks to our recording engineer and editor, Bob, to David and John, our producers, and to John for arranging our theme music, as well as all the others who support us along the way.
If you would like to support us and the podcast, rate and review us on your podcatcher of choice, though I will stress that Apple does really get the algorithm going for us. Or find us on Patreon at patreon.com/thelorehounds. Subscribers will get access to ad-free versions of all the podcasts, as well as many other benefits.
So until next time, then, remember, the wise also look upon what is in our hearts. Halvar, farewell for now.
Nakamin, until we meet again.
Okay, David, this is where we're supposed to choose a side, green or black.
John, my soul is as black as night. Your turn.
I am black for life.
So we're not fighting? I thought this is where HBO wanted us to, like, pick sides and fight and stuff.
Don't worry, I'm sure we'll find plenty to disagree about on the pod, but we seem to agree on one thing. We both really like this show.
The politics, the drama, the lore. It was made for the Lorehounds.
And since we just finished recapping season 1, we couldn't be more ready to defend our Black Queen in the Dance of the Dragons.
And with the season pass option in Supercast, listeners can get early ad-free access to each weekly scene-by-scene deep dive, plus our custom show guide with all the characters and connections. See you in the Lorehounds podcast feed each week for our Dragonfire hot, but probably positive, takes.
The Lorehounds House of the Dragon coverage is also safe for teen green consumption. Side effects may include a deeper understanding of dragon lore, a hardened conflict with itself, and an inescapable urge to read the book Fire and Blood by George R.R. Martin. Dragon seeds may experience burning.